A remote fantastical kingdom far from Europe's chancelleries of power. An ancient castle where secrets are walled up. An unpopular monarch on the eve of his coronation. A ruling class of plotters and would-be usurpers. And a gentleman adventurer on holiday. No, not Ruritania in the 19th century, but the United Kingdom in the 21st. Stein's new book, The Prisoner of Windsor, is a contemporary inversion of Anthony Hope's classic, The Prisoner of Zenda. In the original, an English gentleman on vacation is called upon to stand in for his lookalike, the King of Ruritania, at his coronation. Over a century later, a Ruritanian on vacation in London is called upon to return the favour and stand in for an Englishman in an absurd fantastical kingdom where Brexit never quite happened. Plots are afoot. The Prisoner of Windsor by Mark Stein. Available in hardback and digital editions, or for a personally autographed copy, go to steinonline.com.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
That is the John Barry-tinged version of our theme tune with the 007 flourishes at the intro and outro because it is being rumoured. We have a new James Bond, a chap called Aaron Taylor Johnson. He appears to be white, male, non-trans and heterosexual. So I'm personally seriously doubtful that he will be the new James Bond. But maybe we'll dust off our 007 outro for the end of the show. We did them as a tribute to John Barry when he died, quite a while ago now. March 20th, 2024 in North America. We have sprung into summer and you guys in the rest of the world are still fallen in winter. So it is 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland. But beyond North America, we are at the regular hour. So 8 p.m. in London, 9 p.m. in Paris, 10 p.m. in Jerusalem, 11 p.m. in Yemen. For all you Houthis, hooting out there. 11:30 in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran for the half-hour time zone. 1:45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 4 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, I'm sorry about that. 7 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne. 9 a.m. in Auckland. A rather more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeree, and even deeper into Thursday in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific, where you're so far ahead, I've probably already lost my appeal by now. Not got much of a voice today, and I'm a bit over-medicated, but I'm going to see if we can stagger through to the end of the hour. Man versus Stein is now cruising into its 13th year. No hurry about it. As you know, I filed a flurry of motions last week, and Michael E. Mann asked for an extension of time in order to respond to them. So the fifth trial judge has very kindly given him another month till late April. I think I said I wouldn't live to see this thing reach the Supreme Court. At this rate, I won't live to see it get out of the lousy District of Columbia Superior Court. I thank all of you in these trying times who bought a CHUM, a Stein Online gift certificate, or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. If you know someone who would like either, do give them a thought. Today, March 20th, is the United Nations. This is official. United Nations, super official. So listen up. Today is the official United Nations International Day of Happiness. 2 years ago, for the International Day of Happiness, the UN created an official Ukrainian smiley. That's worked out great for the Ukrainian people. So I hope that even now the United Nations is working on an official Haitian smiley. A big smile as you pop a fellow Haitian's body part into your mouth. The UN has created a list of 10 things you can do to bring about global happiness. Number one is do things that make you happy. Like seize the airport and overthrow the government. But number eight is advance UN goals for sustainable development. Which personally I always find a bit of a downer. Still, I suppose given the inclinations of the UN, we should be grateful number eight isn't cross the border into southern Israel and gang rape a Jewess. Nonetheless, happy International Day of Happiness to you and yours. You can't ask for more than a happy happiness day, can you? On Monday, I noted that of the six most powerful heads of government in the British Isles, a remarkable four of them are from families of the Indian subcontinent. Well, just 48 hours later, and one of them is headed for the exits in Dublin. Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, has announced his resignation. Okay, let's get to your questions. William in Texas says, "Dear Mr. Stein, I think you are wrong when you say this. There is no turbulence." That's a reference. I can't take credit for that formulation. That's George Orwell. George Orwell went to a miners' meeting, and he expected them to be all het up about everything. And he found them insufficiently agitated, and he said there is no turbulence left in England. And it's an open question where there is any turbulence left these days. But William says there is turbulence, but it lacks direction. And because it lacks direction, it takes the form of self-destructive behaviour, like addiction and despair leading to suicide, or intense anger and hatred resulting in mass shootings. I think you're correct that Indian National Congress-style civil disobedience will get us nowhere. Instead, I now think that President Trump, the people at VDARE, that's the website VDARE.com, which is an anti-immigration website, and because it's anti-immigration, it's being targeted by Letitia James, the same awful, ghastly Attorney General in New York who managed to find a judge willing to fine Trump $500 million. I now think that President Trump, the people at VDARE, and the states should ignore federal law and Supreme Court decisions until the federal government actually does something to fix the damn problems afflicting this country. If Republican politicians in power at the state and local level would start actively pushing back, millions would get behind them and the turbulence would be directed in a productive manner. Personally, continues William, I no longer think this country is worth saving. I feel the same way about the United States as my in-laws did about the Soviet Union. I hate the Constitution. I hate its starry banner striped with so much blood. And I hate this land of quote-unquote freedom too. American freedom be damned. Freedom to do what? Watch porn, get high on opiates? Freedom to be a degenerate is not freedom. If there is a war between China, Russia and the USA and EU, I hope China and Russia win, and I hope there are Nuremberg-style trials for Lindsey Graham, Boris Johnson, Emmanuel Macron, and all those wretched upstart swine who rose above their station. These people do not know the pain and suffering they have inflicted on me and my family and countless other families and persons, not only in Ukraine and Russia, but Libya, Syria, Iraq, Serbia, and God knows where else. Yours faithfully, William in Texas. That's a very sad letter to receive William. William, I should perhaps explain, you may not know this, but he was in fact working in Ukraine until the people he mentioned, Lindsey Graham and Boris Johnson, managed to put an end to that. I sympathise with what you're saying. I said a few months ago on this show, rather despairingly, you know, that all the countries I loved, I now hold in memory because they're not what they are, and the little bits of what they are not going to be there. They remain, you know, you can find pockets, but they're not going to be made there much longer. That's true of Ireland, which we just mentioned. That's true of Canada. That's true of France. That's true of all kinds of places. And you are correct, too, to say that freedom to watch porn and die face down in a meth lab is not freedom. There's a reason, though, why there is a lack. Well, there's a couple of reasons why there's a lack of turbulence. There is despair, and I'm not persuaded that the people who are dying from despair, we have falling life expectancy in the United States. It doesn't get more basic than that. We have, for whether it's because of the vaccines or it's because of the fentanyl or because it's whatever, there are people who don't make their 70 and instead die in middle age and youth in incredible numbers. And that is that to me is a kind of slightly separate thing from lack of turbulence. We don't have the despair is bad, and something needs to be done about the despair. But as we see, it's becoming, you know, the point of life, the point of a dignified life. A life is a compact between the present, the past, and the future. And so if life has no dignity, if you're living in parts of the country where all the factories have gone to China, you know, your grandparents were able to raise a family on a nice lot in a non-criminal part of town with a three-bedroomed house or a four-bedroomed house while working a blue-collar job. And their grandchildren now go to crappy colleges that are not educational institutions and get some worthless degree and earn less than their grandparents did. And so family formation starts later. So you become you can't afford to have a kid when you're 22. You're still in the fourth year of colonialism and transgender studies. So all the structural defects are all the consequences of them are becoming more plain every day. But turbulence is a different thing. There is no the reason for the lack of turbulence is because the people who were turbulent on January the 6th are now in jail. And people who are perceived to have supported that turbulence, such as this chap I mentioned this morning, this county commissioner somewhere in New Mexico, is banned for life from holding elective office. Peter Navarro, who was one of the, you know, a lot of Trump officials abandoned him in the fortnight after January 6th. Some of them resigned a few days before they would have left office anyway. And some of them attacked him and all the rest of it. Peter Navarro, who was one of the few who actually took seriously the irregularities in the election, he's just gone to jail. He shouldn't be in jail. It's disgraceful, that. But so people are beginning, and again, powerful figures. Rudy Giuliani, one of the most famous men in the United States, is ruined. He's bankrupt. And people are clever about that because it's one of those bollocks things about American law. If you declare bankruptcy, but you put everything in this guy's name and that guy's name. So you continue leading the life you've always had. Well, they're going after his $5 million beach condo in wherever it is, Palm Beach in Florida or wherever it is. You know, so the idea that, which again is a bollocks American law thing. Oh, by declaring bankruptcy, you can go on living the life you always would be leading. No, it's not actually, it isn't actually as easy as that. Not if you're on the wrong side of a lot of this stuff. And so people actually see that. That's why I've said this before, but it bears repeating. The Canadian truckers, and it was a huge inspiration, early 22 years ago now. And it was a big story. Canadian stories don't make news anywhere, even in Canada half the time. This one was all over the planet. At GB News, we all covered it as a great inspiration after the COVID years. And there was talk that it would be replicated in the United States, and there was going to be a big American trucker thing. Imagine that. Imagine if there'd been an American equivalent to what the Canadian truckers did, where they all descended from all across the fruited plain on Washington, D.C., and brought it to a standstill. Never happened. You know why it never happened? Because people looked at grannies, 73-year-old grannies with no criminal records, and they're banged up in solitary in the crap hole of D.C. justice, waiting. You know, they have a constitutional right, like all the rubbish in the Constitution. They have a constitutional right to a speedy trial. But before you get to the speedy trial, you have to have the scheduling conference to set. There's apparently no constitutional right to a scheduling conference for your speedy trial. So they're all banged up in solitary for months and months and months, years and years and years, before getting the highest possible sentences they could get. An awful lot of them wound up committing suicide. If that had been a Republican administration going after Antifa or Black Lives Matter and it was driving people to suicide, you would never hear the end of it. Here, people die and they don't even make the news. It's disgraceful. But that's why there was no American truckers thing, because people got the message. The right, which wastes far too much of its time, you know, waving the Constitution and singing, "I'm proud to be an American, because at least I know I'm screwed." You know, it's like the rituals of a primitive tribe in the jungles of New Guinea that's entirely irrelevant to anything actually happening in the world. And that's one reason I'm so bloody bored by it all. Because for all the decades, "I'm proud to be an American, because at least I know I'm screwed." You know, you've been singing it for decades and everything's been good. At some point, you have to imagine if instead of doing that, the American right had actually shone a spot. The people who shine a spotlight, or, you know, Fox News doesn't cover what's happening to these January 6th guys. Julie Kelly, who I had on Fox News, and believe me, that interview had to go all the way up to the top of the corporate, not quite to Rupert, but just below Rupert. The right has rendered itself irrelevant. I feel very sorry when I listen to William. And I don't know when you're saying that everyone should just ignore. You know, George III didn't have the advantages that whoever's waggling Joe Biden does. He can't just open up his laptop and freeze your bank accounts in the way that Joe Biden does. And I think that's true. I think that's admirable to say everyone should just ignore federal law and Supreme Court decisions. I think that would be good. I think it would help if the state of Texas, for example, were to thank Chief Justice Roberts for his opinion and then entirely ignore what he says. You know, to paraphrase Stalin, how many divisions does Chief Justice Roberts have? You know, it's going to take something like that But when you look at the men and women who govern us, and you're expecting them to lead some great pushback, I don't know about that, William. Heather says, Mark, you're on fire lately. Don't these clowns know that suing you only makes you stronger? I wish that were true. I have a dispute between doctors in different countries now about how many heart attacks I've had. So my heart attacks, the enumeration of my heart attacks is now taken on the same condition as whatever stupid congressional district that is in upstate New York that takes 3 months to determine how many votes have actually been cast. So I wish that was true, but I thank you for the thought. Keep up the fight, says Heather. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on, as Daily Mail opinion writers describe it, the impending implosion of the royal family, the slimming down, the health crises, the unexplained absences, and the photo fail firestorm, all on top of the disgrace of members the king apparently won't completely cut off. I recall some years ago your jovial disagreement with those who found no use in the modern royals and the traditions of the monarchy. At the time, I would have joked that my indifference was American. I stopped caring about royal weddings in 1776. But I found myself persuaded. Is it collapsing? Well, I should just, you know, I'm not a big... I did some parody royal wedding coverage on Rush one day. I think it was for... Was it William and Kate? I can't remember which one it was now. But the... I'm not interested in monarchy as celebrity or as tradition. I'm interested in monarchy as a system of government. Because, you know, setting aside the House of Windsor and my own particular country, the deranged Dominion of Canada, monarchy can be said to work pretty well in those continental European nations that retain it. It's certainly a valid system of government. And, you know, where I was mocking the prancing around with the Constitution routine, that's obviously, if you step back, and to be honest, a lot of so-called constitutional scholars don't step back, but, you know, the pledging of allegiance to the Constitution is there because when the American Republic was set up, there was an obvious hole where the monarch is. And, you know, as a matter of law, the monarch is the state is the monarch, as the old French guy said, l'état, c'est moi, the state is me. And that is true, literally. The king is the legal personification of the Canadian state. In America, so if you take that out, you've got to have something else that becomes the legal personification of the state. And Americans chose to make it the Constitution. And that may be all well and good, but half the country, and significantly more than half under the age of 50... does not believe that to be the case. There are, you know, as I said, there are drawbacks to all systems. I mentioned the Venetian Republic, which lasted 1,000 very good years, which is four times as long as the American Republic seems likely to last on its present trajectory. But you're right that something very odd is going on in the royal family. Now, the Queen held the whole thing together. The Queen... was born at a time when there was a huge extended royal family. George V, during the war, had sort of cut off the ones who'd gone, a few who'd gone over to the German side and things. But it was still a vast royal family, and they supply, you know, the Duke of Connaught, whom the Queen knew for the first two decades of her life, more or less. The Duke of Connaught, Queen Victoria's son, was an excellent Governor General of Canada, and the Earl of Athlone also was an excellent Governor General of Canada, and Just before the Queen came to the throne, the Duke of Gloucester was Governor General of Australia, and a very good Governor General of Australia. But she had no expectation when she was born that her house would survive, because the royal houses of her cousins in various parts of, well, the Romanovs, you know what a bloody end they met. The Habsburgs had ended in Austria, the Hohenzollerns in Germany. It was the 20th century was not an age of kings. It was an age of republics, and the most powerful societies became republics. The Queen, and then we have the decolonization, where people are saying, well, I don't want to be a subject of the Great White Queen thousands of miles away anymore. I think we should throw off the monarchy. And the Queen managed to hold all that together for 7 decades. And she transformed her empire into a commonwealth that, you know, if you're an imperialist, is a bit of a wacky thing. But she made it a thing. She basically, a lot through her the power of her personality, she made it a thing. She presided over that transition so seamlessly that a lot of its unique accomplishments were not fully grasped until she died, and this nitwit ascended the throne, a guy who thinks he's brainy and was born to rule. In a way that the Queen certainly didn't think. And so his whole thing is, well, we don't need all these Dukes of Connaught and Gloucester and whatever anymore. So I'm going to slim down the royal family. He then has this mysterious cancer. The next Queen, Kate, as the Americans say, is ill, and nobody really knows how sick the King is, although You look at his, you know, engagements. He had an audience. Rishi Sunak had an audience with him, and Justin Trudeau had a video audience with the sovereign. And he saw the was it the High Commissioner of Jamaica for something or other. He's not doing a lot. Nobody. So this is slightly odd. And then we have the next queen. In the event that he were to keel over and die tomorrow, William and Kate would be king and queen. And she's been unseen, and we don't know why. What that is about. There is something. There is something going on other than what we have been told. That's not a conspiracy theory. And I'm not saying that she's dead or whatever the wackier rumours are. But there's something going on other than what we have been officially told. And the slimmed down model that he, I mentioned the Duke of Gloucester's son, the present Duke of Gloucester, he and the Duchess are doing all the hard. They were there at the Commonwealth Day ceremony. They're doing half the work now. There isn't anybody else. The Duke of Kent is too old, and the. Duke of York is in disgrace, and there's, Harry is writing books about his ginger todger. And this is, so the King has buggered his whole philosophy that he's been waiting decades to implement is been completely wrong. And I think these are very grave times for the royal family. But I take monarchy as a serious system of government, because it has been the preferred system of government for most of human existence in one form or another. And I certainly think I think it's important in society to have something above politicians. And one reason for having a monarchy is that there's always a certain percentage of people are chippy about it. Oh, why do I have to have this bloke who's just, the king because his great, 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 great grandfather was king? Why do I have to put up with that? And that's good. It's healthy to have chippiness about your rulers. And as you know, I love the way in I wrote about this, and it bears repeating that, you know, the Canadian press went bananas when they found out that the Royal Flight of the Royal Canadian Air Force, which is just some great big bone shaker, that they'd sort of refurbished it for William and Kate. What refurbished meant was that a lady from Canadian Forces base at Trenton, Ontario, had gone to Canadian Tire and bought a comforter set for $120 Canadian. So that's like 73 cents US. And the Canadian press still went bananas about it, because if you've got a monarchy, every little thing is under scrutiny. Whereas if you're Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, you get to fly home to San Francisco every weekend on a government plane. You know, William has been photographed flying coach and putting his luggage in the overhead rack. Do you think Nancy Pelosi, she's not even Speaker anymore, do you think she still gets to fly home on a government plane? Every weekend. You know, anyway, that's why I like that. Israel Pickholtz writes from Israel. It isn't technically necessary for people asking questions to have the same name as the country they're asking questions from. But we might introduce it so that if you're called Sydney, you might have to be writing from New South Wales. Or if you're called Stanley, you might have been writing from the Falkland Islands. But Israel Pickholtz says, Mark, do you believe that the people who actually run the Democrat Party already know who will be cast as president and vice president going forward and exactly how they will script it? Or perhaps they are still waiting to see how things will play out. And if they have decided, do you think the new people already know their roles? Well, the obvious answer to that is that the Democrats generally are ahead of the Republicans. You know, we have all the, oh, we, so-and-so is playing 4D chess or whatever. The Democrats played their 4D chess brilliantly in the year 2020, while the right busy, you know, waving the Constitution, singing I'm proud to be an American. The Democrats were actually planning how to ensure that they, quote unquote, won the election. They got the electoral laws changed, in many cases entirely unconstitutionally, but they were four steps ahead, to the point where they knew that even if anybody complained about the election laws in this or that state being changed unconstitutionally, the John Roberts Supreme Constitutional Court would decline to hear those cases. So Democrats are generally a few steps ahead of Republicans. So it's interesting to look at the polls where Trump is opening up wider and wider leads in all the so-called battleground states. But you got to bet, and people are saying, well, you know, do you think we should have Joe Biden on the bat? There, if they decide that Joe Biden is not going to be their guy on November the whatever it is, you can be sure that they have come up with an eventuality that the Republicans have not anticipated. That's the thing. They're playing. They won, quote unquote, in 2020, because they were playing further ahead than Republicans. The whole, and this is again why the whole conservative right approach of just reacting to what AOC or Chuck Schumer has said today. You know, if you're always just reacting to what the Democrats have already said or done, don't be surprised you're manoeuvred when the other guys don't really care what you say or do, because they're far ahead. Right now, as you know, during the Durham Report years, the right was still obsessing on what happened in 2016, and the Democrats had moved on to stealing 2024, which is the more effective approach. That's a very good question. Elisa Angel says, were Irish PM Leo Varadkar and Kamala Harris's husband Doug Emhoff separated at birth? They look like twins. I don't think it's a separated at birth thing. Although Leo Varadkar and Kamala Harris are both British subjects by virtue of their Indian heritage, both. There always has to be one in an American election. Don't quite know why. That's something else that you should have checked out of in 1776. But I don't think it's an identical twins thing. I think a lot of these people are just actually made in a factory round the back of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Elisa adds, now that Varadkar's resigned, could Ireland get an even worse leader than Varadkar? Who will replace Varadkar? Is there any hope for Ireland? I don't know whether it goes back to the Fianna Fáil guy, or there's another Fianna Gael guy who's going to take. Because basically The two parties that have governed Ireland more or less since Ireland became an independent state are currently ruling in coalition with the Greens to keep out Sinn Féin. But I don't even want to bother talking about that, because the whole thing is that changes of prime minister and president are irrelevant. They only matter if you get a change in the direction of the government, which, as we've seen with Giorgia Meloni in Italy, and it looks like it will be the same with Geert Wilders and co. in the Netherlands, doesn't happen. The whole thing is that everyone should be excited. Oh, breaking news, this prime minister's resigned. Who's going to succeed him? Well, we're going to be looking at the top five front runners with my special panel for the full hour, right? There was a lot of that on GB News when I was there. except it got very boring, because the Conservative government was changing prime ministers every 48 hours. So it became very boring. And the whole point is that these people, that's one reason why they're doing it between elections now. It doesn't matter who's prime minister. It doesn't matter who's president. So this guy's going because he's been offered a big gig at the World Economic Forum or whatever, and so we're going to put this guy in. That's the whole point, that you can change the front man, but you're never going to change what's going on in the back office. That's the lesson that they are trying to teach us. And it, as I said, in normal conditions, it would create pre-revolutionary conditions in normal at any other time in history. But these days, you know, everyone knows that they can freeze your bank account in seconds and all of it. So they have powers. They have things they can do very easily. You know, imagine the Boston Tea Party. If George III over in Buckingham Palace had just been, let's get the video identification of all these guys. This is what they did with the January 6th, the FBI. Tracked them all down. They were living, some of them were living 2,000 miles away. Tracked them all down and then ruined their lives. Imagine if George III had that kind of facial recognition technology in Buckingham Palace. You think the Boston Tea Party would have been a thing? You think if he could have just frozen their accounts with the Colonial Bank of Boston in seconds, that it would have been a thing? You know, there are things happening that they're creating the conditions in which revolution would be impossible. Let's pause a moment from the passing Charivari for a musical interlude. Last week I mentioned a BBC story about women wanting to rename all the lady parts, because all the lady parts are named after men, like the fallopian tube. Don't know whether you've ever come across that one, but the fallopian tube is named after the first bloke to discover it. I have no idea how he stumbled upon it, but one hopes it was consensually. That was Dr. Fallopius in Latin, or Dr. Fallopio in Italian. At which point last week, I found myself singing unprompted, Yamma yamma ya, Fallopio Fallopia. And as a result, I've had that Neapolitan earworm in my head all week. So it is time to purge it. Written to commemorate the opening of the funicular railway on Mount Vesuvius in 1880 and a global hit for almost a century and a half now. What a song. Here's Pavarotti.
Più di spiette far me non può. Adollo fuoco coce ma si cuglie e lassa sta. E non te copre a priesse, non te struie, solo a guardar. Iammo, iammo, coppa, iammo, iammo. Coppa yammaya, cule 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 cula, cule 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 cula. Yamma yammaya, cule 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 cula. Sempre dello tuo reno, scusa mai me. Yamma, yamma, coppa yamma, 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 coppa yamma, puli, 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 coppa yamma, puli, 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 puli.
Luciano Pavarotti with the Cora del Teatro Comunale di Bologna and the National Philharmonic Orchestra from the UK, conducted by Anton Guadagno, a record I used to play at the very dawn of what passes for my career. Music by Luigi Denza, words by Peppino Turca, and just a terrific match of words and music, really excellent. Much parodied in the years since. If you've read America Alone, and if you haven't, you should, because it's a long time now, but I got an awful lot of things right in that book. But if you have read America Alone, you will know I quote Noel Coward in there. Funiculi, funicula, funic yourself. Indeed. But I'm also partial to Alan Sherman's version. Gina, Gina, Lola Brigida, I like Herbert, que sera, sera. That song was a monster hit from 1880. We'll have another hit from the 80s a little later, but this time the 1980s, because any old show can operate a 1980s hits format or an 1880s hits format, but we are the only show on earth That does both. Mark Stein, live around the planet. It is 17 to 5 North American Eastern Time. That is 17 to 9 Greenwich Mean Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us get back to your questions. Amy Boney Carrot, possibly not her real name, says, can you comment on Trump's inability to read the room re-vaccine efficacy and safety, his awarding Fauci a medal on his way out, his 15 minutes to flatten the curve that was extended and extended wrecking lives and businesses. I fear his statements will be very off-putting for many, and they may decide to sit this one out in disgust. What say you? I'm not sure about that last point, Miss Boney Carrot. But I do think it's revealing, this whole thing about the vaccine efficacy and safety. We had some on the Mark Stein show during that year of 2020. We had a lot of... What was interesting to me was that people didn't... People took against Fauci from the get-go. You know, really, literally 4 years ago, when he and Deborah Birx, who actually may have been more powerful than Fauci when it came to a lot of things, when they started dominating the screen, doing these like 2-hour press conferences with Trump in the Oval Office every night in the early days of the thing. And people out there took against Fauci super quickly. And they'd write to me saying, Fauci this, Fauci that. I'd say, Fauci's just some civil servant. I mean, yes, he's like the J. Edgar Hoover of public health. He's been there since the late 1960s, you know, doing the same job, essentially. But he is, you know, he is just a civil servant. He's a guy in, you know, room 473 of whatever stupid, crappy office building he is. Trump is the head of the, I mean, I shouldn't have to say this, although after that 4-year term, it is necessary to say this. Trump is the head of the executive branch. Fauci's an employee. So this idea that, oh, Fauci this, Fauci that, well, okay, Trump should fire Fauci. If he'd fired, they were extraordinary times. He could easily have fired Fauci and said, I just didn't feel he was up to, you know, there was a big pandemic and I didn't feel he was taking it seriously enough. He could have used, Fauci's been every which way on every, oh, you don't need to wear a mask. Yeah, when he said that, he could have gotten rid of him in the first few weeks and things would have been very different. And I remember saying on a couple of episodes of the Mark Stein show, the idea that Fauci is more powerful than the president of the United States is not going to fly. And what that told me, I think one of the things, I mean, everybody who went through those years became more socially isolated because there was like, you know, in some places you weren't allowed to leave the house. And even if you did leave the house, there was nowhere to go. So people generally were exposed to a much narrower range of opinions and the sense of the feeling. And I think Trump just grew totally isolated in that period. Peter Navarro, who's now disgracefully has gone to jail, Peter Navarro refers to Jared and Ivanka as the Democrats in his book. He says in the White House they were known as the Democrats. And that's why, as Black Lives Matter and Antifa are looting and burning in half the cities of America, Trump comes and touts his big plan, you know, to let more people out of jail. Oh, okay. You think, now, Harry, you can't go to the Wendy's round the corner. You got to go to the Wendy's 2 miles away. But I thought I'd let more people out of jail. You know, so he was totally tone deaf during that year, his last year. And I think that was in part because he wasn't exposed to a wide range of opinion. You know, he was Sean Hannity was having dinner with him two or three times a week. And I like Sean. He's very nice. But he's not the kind of guy to actually say, listen, Mr. President, I like you. You know, I want you to win. But this thing, you know, so he wasn't. So he's not the kind of guy to do that. Mark Levin isn't the kind of guy to do that. So I think he was isolated. And it's but it's this. And what's disturbing about Amy Boney Carrot's thing is that is this idea now that that he's still talking up the vaccines, even though the crowds just fall silent and in some cases they boo because they like Trump despite the lockdown year. And some of them don't even like Trump, but are willing to vote for Trump because the Democrats basically are erecting a one-party state where they control all the levers of power and influence in the state. And Trump is is mainly the guy on the receiving end, although, as I said, there are the January 6thers and there's Peter Navarro and there's all these other ruined people. So there's a lot of people who'll be voting for Trump, not because they liked that last year, but because they don't like basically the one-party state that the Democrats are erecting before our eyes. And all the right, you know, oh, well, the Republican Party is brimming with talent. Oh, yeah, well, the main opposition, the main alternative to Trump turned out to be Nikki Haley, who, as Vivek Ramaswamy said, is basically Dick Cheney in heels. The Republican voters don't want to go back. They don't want to go back to a country that fights wars in places it can't even find on the map. Dithers around for 20 years, huge cost in blood and treasure, and then winds up losing to goat herds with fertilizer. Nikki Haley is basically what Dick Cheney would look like if he decided to transition. And so there was no viable alternative. So it's Trump because Trump has been the victim of a totally disgraceful conspiracy between the permanent state and the Democrats and the media. And the priority is actually to reverse that. But going on about these vaccines, if there were ever a, you know, thank God for Sweden, who suffered no consequences for just keeping. I love those pictures. It used to cheer me up. You know, when I didn't set foot in the Fox News headquarters. I haven't actually set foot in it since in 4 years now. Because they were restricting it, which I thought was like pretty stupid. So I managed to do everything, all the stuff from my, when I'd be guest hosting for Tucker or whatever, I did it all from our studio. And once I'd done that a few times, I didn't want to go any, I didn't want to bother going to New York anymore. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at those things in Sweden, if you look at life in Stockholm or whatever, little Swedish towns, they're all in bars, they're all in restaurants, having a grand old time, having a fabulous summer and all the rest of it. And that would have been a time for Trump to actually just step back and not be guided, not be buffaloed by these people. And the Operation Warp Speed, you know, a lot of people are dead and injured because those things were rushed through. And there isn't any evidence that they've saved millions and millions of lives or whatever ridiculous claim is made. And we have now huge amounts of excess. You just look at what the insurers are saying, the American Association of Actuaries. They don't have an axe to grind. They just don't want to have to keep paying out money to guys who die at 34. It's and so what that tells me is that Trump is still not is still. This is what's so frustrating for me. I'm not one of these people who wants to go to Mar-a-Lago and kiss ass every week. I have no desire to. I have no desire to fly internally in the United States. It's such a miserable experience. But the point is, he has to have. He won in. Whatever it was now, 8 years ago, because in 2015 and 2016, he was brilliantly in tune with where enough of the electorate were. Brilliantly. I was amazed by that. I've written about that before. When you went to see, people found it funny. They liked it when he'd, you know, start talking about the Iranian nuclear program and then detour into how Macy's stock had tanked since they dropped Trump ties. It was hilarious. It was funny. But people were also moved by it because for the first time, there was a Republican candidate at a time when Marco Rubio was calling for a second American century and John Kasich was doing soft focus crapola about how he's proud to be the son of a milkman, not a milkman, mailman, son of a mailman. Maybe it was the milkman. Who knows? Because he was talking about something real. He was talking about Kate Steinle being killed because of the open borders that have just been opened wider now. He was talking about something and the connection between him and his voters. They couldn't have been closer. It wasn't one of those clothespin elections like when you nominate Mitt Romney or whoever. It wasn't like that, or John McCain or whatever. They were on the same page. And it is worrying when it appears that he's not on the same page. Hart says, prayers for continued improvement of your health, Mark. I hope it's improving. I won't get into that. Your conversation with Conrad Black reinforced my belief in the utter corruption and incompetency of the US legal system. This was our special show from the Mark Steyn Cruise, which is available on our website, me in conversation with Conrad Black. Hart continues, it also brought to mind the recent Supreme Court decision against Colorado's effort to remove Trump from its ballot. The decision was obviously correct. In multiple articles, the justices were quoted as saying that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment did not apply and doubted that this section, quoting Justice Roberts here, lets a single state have such a broad impact on a presidential election. But hold on. In 2021, the court refused to hear Texas's case against Georgia for Georgia violating its own constitution in accepting as legal all sorts of voting anomalies. The Supremes then said 9-0 that Texas had no standing in a matter concluded by Georgia. So on one hand, the Supremes decided that Georgia's violation of its own laws had no bearing on anyone else. Yet now a primary justification for this most recent decision is that an action of Colorado could indeed affect other states. Perhaps if the court had performed their constitutional duty in 2021, much injustice could have been avoided. Am I wrong? Look, that's you're right, absolutely right, that there's no logic or consistency in the Supreme Court's decisions. But you're not looking at it the way John Roberts looks at it. And this is a problem that arises when you make five judges essentially the arbiters of every major question in American life. Because in a healthier system, that would be left to the people's representatives, the politicians. And what happens then when you turn 9 judges into the Supreme Intergalactic Council is that they start acting as politicians. So John Roberts is looking at this thing in political terms. You reference that Texas case against Georgia. It's not correct that they have no standing. If the state of Georgia decides to change its laws on double parking, well, right, the state of Texas doesn't have any standing to bring a suit against that because it's not impacted by it. But the state of Texas is most certainly impacted if the state of Georgia decides to adopt an unconstitutional means of determining its electoral college votes. That's obviously it has standing. But here's where the politics comes in. By that point, Joe Biden had been proclaimed president. He was the president-elect, and we were in the midst of the stupid three-month peaceful transition of power. And so is John Roberts going to undo the election results and proclaim that no, Joe Biden is not the president? No, he's not going to do that. And there's a lot of people who wouldn't do it either because, you know, the Democrats have got a paramilitary wing, as you can see on the streets, and they will, it's not, everybody knows where these guys live, and they'll just come and burn your house down. So he's not going to do that, and you're quite right. But again, this is where the Republican stupid, well, you know, what matters is that we get the guy elected president, and then he can appoint all these rock-ribbed conservatives to the Supreme Court. How is that working? How is abandoning every other institution and influence in society? Well, what matters is, you know, I don't like Mitt Romney. I don't like Susan Collins. But we'll at least we'll be able to nominate a judge and put him on the Supreme. How's that working out? It's a stupid and reductive view of politics is about persuading the masses. It's supposed to be self-government. It's not to say, well, you know, we'll let the left do all the persuading. So now in every middle school across the country, girls are having their breasts chopped off and being rendered infertile because the left is much more persuasive on that than we were, and they control these institutions. But just you wait. If one of these little girls in 20 years' time decides to sue the such and such school district for rendering her infertile and she gets it to the Supreme Court, we've got this 6-3 rock-ribbed conservative majority on the Supreme Court that will turn all that around. It's not enough. It's not enough. As I said on Tucker, a judge's republic is a contradiction in terms. And Tucker did that famous head tilt of his and repeated the line and said he hadn't thought of it like that. But it's perfectly true. You know, you got to get out there. You got to pursue. We're losing. We're losing, not just because the state has all this power, but for other reasons, too, that the, you know, it's an aspirational. The American dream, you know, says, oh, we're not Europe. In Europe, if you were a peasant in the 12th century, you're a peasant in the 18th century. It's not like that here. The American dream means you can fulfill every aspect of your dreams if you just work hard enough and you just do this and you just do that. Well, as you know, one of the big problems is that a lot of the conservative movement in America contents itself, as Veronica points out from in our comment section frequently, with what are regarded as low status things. So all the high status things, you know, this is part of the problem is that the people who are The people who are put out there to speak for the Democrats are influencers in society. You know, they're movie stars and all the rest and all the rest of it. And if you're not even playing on that turf, you're going to be in the end you can't be surprised in an aspirational society where people don't want to be a peasant, just like their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was. The people are taking their cues are from the people who are on the way up. I mean, that's a big part of the problem. The court isn't going to. The court just this week declined to take the case of that guy in New Mexico who was banned for life from standing for office. Banned for life for standing for office because he stepped over a barricade at the United States Capitol. I did that 25 years ago. I turned up for the first day of the Clinton impeachment trial, which I was covering for newspapers in Canada, the UK, and various other places. And as usual, it's all rubbish, and you can never find anyone to tell you where to go. And a policeman, so I asked the security guy, and the security guy goes, "Oh, you're here for the impeachment trial. We see that, because I had to get a picture ID from whoever it was." He said, "Well, I'll tell you where to go for that. You see that yellow tape saying police line, do not cross?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Just step over that and go round the corner of the building and you'll come to..." Right? That's basically what this county commissioner did. And he is banned for life. But the Supreme Court declined to take his case. They're not going to be there for you, folks. They're not going to be there for you. Eric Dale said, this is on the same kind of subject. This is about, Eric wants to know about the Murphy versus Missouri oral arguments. This is basically the Twitter files in court, the revelations there. The Supreme Court has held oral hearings about the pressure applied to Twitter and so forth. Matt Taibbi and Powerline's Scott Johnson have both written, and the feeling is that the Supreme Court could very well rule that the federal government has the right, through its partners in social media companies, to quell misinformation. You're right that the oral hearings, oral arguments, were not encouraging on this front. It wasn't just Ketanji Brown Jackson or whatever she's called. This is the other thing, too. You know, there are clearly these are not the nine most eminent judges in the land, and the things they were saying about, oh, wouldn't this hamstring the government? The point about the First Amendment is to hamstring the government, this was not an... I should probably just move on from court stuff, because the basic thing here is, you know, don't expect the courts to save you. That is not the function of courts. And actually, once you start having this idea of the court as the deus ex machina, that's not going to work for you. That's just not going to work for you. Teresa Maupin says, this is more culture. Other than a few sources, as in very few, why do you think new alternative media ignored your defamation case? Well, they didn't really all ignore. But I tell you, a 12-year lawsuit is hard to follow. It's hard to know. So you've got to expend a lot of effort getting up to speed on it. The mainstream media, their way of dealing with stories unhelpful to the narrative is not to cover it. So the Washington Post guy showed up on the ninth day of the trial, I believe it was, The others didn't send a reporter at all. And in fact, that Washington Post guy was not a court reporter. He was just like a climate correspondent. And if you notice, all the mainstream coverage covered it as, oh, attacks on climate scientists have got to cease, right? So to actually cover what's going on in the case is complicated. And when you talk about alternative media, I like the idea of alternative media and all the rest of it. But actually, 95% of that is just commenting on what the mainstream media say. So that if you go to EaglePatriotMinuteman.com, the great right-wing news aggregator, they're just commenting on, you know, a story in the Washington Post saying that America now has more transgender admirals than any other country on the planet. And then they'll mock and hoot and laugh at that. And that's very easy to do, and it's fine. But a lawsuit is different. You've got to actually have a court reporter who understands law and who's willing to go and sit. You know, and this isn't just my case. Even cases that covered. You know, why are Ann and Phelim's podcasts about the Harvey Weinstein trial better than any other coverage? Because they were sitting there in court. They were covering it, and they made the point that Harvey Weinstein is a disgusting, grotesque pig, but that the prosecution had not made its case, which is what is supposed to happen in a trial. And only by being there, covering it, following everything, can you understand all that. Todd Hines says, have you seen that one of the complainants in your long ago Canadian Human Rights Commission case, then an activist student and now an immigration lawyer, has been made a member of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal? And now that the vanquished Section 13 has been revived as Online Harms Bill C-63, the tribunal will once again be hearing online hate speech cases. So if / when you find yourself before the tribunal, you would discover that your accuser has become your judge and jury. How's that for a fair hearing? Yes, this is Nassim Mithouani, who was one of the so-called Canadian Islamic Congress sock puppets, as we called them and as they became generally known. Who took me to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, the Ontario Human Rights Commission, and the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal. And Nassim is now on the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal and feels that Section 13 should be reintroduced and is looking forward. There were three of them. There was a fourth one, but he dropped out pretty quickly. So there were three of them. There was Nassim and Muneza Sheikh and Kurama Wan. He was the bloke. He was a bit of a nosebleed. But Nassim and Muneza were very pleasant for the most part. I met them at a TV Ontario tried to stitch me up. They'd interview me, and then they'd have the sock puppet saying what a racist I was. It was a complete stitch up. They didn't tell my publicist. She was furious about it. I said, oh, don't worry, I'll go on the show and wreck all that. So at one point I pointed to the host, Steve Paikin, and said, you've got those my accusers over there, and you're not letting it. Here we're on the same show, but you're not going to let us talk. And he goes, oh, it's a bit of a seating issue. We have difficulty with the seats. I said, it's not a seating issue. So anyway, we did wind up having a little bit of a bank. And I wandered in. I remember wandering into makeup and seeing this glossy black hair, thinking, oh, wow, that chick is smoking hot. And it turned out to be one of the ladies. I'm just riffing here. As I remember saying to Ken White, my editor at the National Post, and then Maclean's, I remember saying to Ken over lunch, I've always been very partial to Islamo-totty. And he said, you are never to say that in a column. So, of course, I did what I usually do, and I put it in the column 2 days later. But they were, I should have, they were they were smart, as my friend Julian Porter, KC, testified in Ezra Levant's trial. They were smart, and they were not to be underestimated. And, you know, there were moments during the trial at the British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal. I remember having one conversation with Muneeza Sheikh. I've run into her a couple of times since, but and she's, you know, it's possible. I prefer it to Michael Mann. Mann wouldn't speak to anybody on the other side in his case. And I think a lot has changed since then, that we could all talk, or at least we could. The expectation was that you could have a conversation. If you happened to bump into them in the corridor, you could have a conversation. And I remember one absolutely delightful conversation with Muneeza, in which we went back and forth on a lot of things. She had a completely different... She thought I was I had traduced her faith, and she was not happy about that, and she wanted the Canadian state to ensure that it didn't happen again. But, you know, we chit-chatted, and we chit-chatted. In fact, I chit-chatted with all three of them after that awful show on TV Ontario with Steve Paikin. They had to kick us out at the... I mean, I remember saying on air when Steve goes, well, that's all we have time for. And I just looked at the ladies. I looked at Nassim and Muneeza and said, why don't we go? I said, well, you know, because we wanted to continue it. So I said to Muneeza and Nassim, do you want to go to dinner? And Karamawan shouted, no! And that was basically the end of the show. But, the problem is, as I said back then, is that they are Canada's future and I am the past. And I go back to where we came in with William in Texas, who said he now doesn't want his country to survive. He hates the Constitution, all the rest of it. I loved the Dominion of Canada into which I was born. And I thought it was a fantastic country. And then it wasn't enough for people. And Pierre Trudeau decided to discard hundreds of years of settlement in British North America and turn Canada into something other. And as I said at the time, after my encounter with the three sock puppets, they are the future and I am the past. And we have seen that with the rise of all three of them. In the years since, Nassim is on the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. No chance of me ever getting near the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. I was listening to Pick of the Pops on BBC Radio 2 a couple of weekends back, and Steve Wright was counting down the hit parade from the 1970s, and he played something by Steve Harley. Both Steves had known each other at school at New Cross in southeast London, the old terminus of the East London line, if I recall correctly. And Steve Wright sent his best wishes to Steve Harley, whom he said was rather ill. And I thought, uh-oh, Steve Wright is trying to tell us Steve Harley's cancer is coming near its inevitable end. That was on the Saturday. On the Monday, Steve Wright died, and so predeceased his old school chum, who eked out another month until the end came last Sunday. Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel, his band, great name for a band in those days, they had a number one record with Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile. But we played that for the death of my old Loose Ends confrere, Annabelle Giles, at the end of last year. So I thought we'd play something else today. Make Me Smile was Steve's biggest hit in the 70s. So how about his biggest hit in the 80s? Steve Harley was on my radio show a little over four decades ago, and I played a version of the splendid him, Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, Hubert Parry, Hubert Parry did the music, that Andrew Lloyd Webber and Richard Stilgo had turned into a big love ballad for Sarah Brightman. And Steve Harley was rather disparaging about both Lloyd Webber and that record. So a couple of years go by, and I'm a bit surprised to see that Steve has made a record of a Lloyd Webber song and as a duet with Sarah Brightman. And one day, I'm strolling down Old Compton Street in Soho, and I bump into Steve, and I remind him of how rude he was about Andrew Lloyd Webber, and he laughs and he goes, "Yeah, but they asked me if I'd like to do it, and I went round to Andrew's pad in Eaton Square, and he was an absolute sweetie. I sang the first 8 bars of the song, and he stopped me and said, 'That's exactly the voice I've been looking for.'" It was the title song from Andrew's forthcoming musical, which was due to open in 9 months' time. And Andrew wanted a big hit record to ballyhoo it. And although the musical itself was lush and Puccini-esque, he wanted more of a rock and roll aesthetic for the pop version. So he asked Mike Batt to arrange and produce and rock it up a bit. You'll have seen and or heard Batty on various iterations of the Mark Stein Show over the years. He was actually on Serenade Song of the Week a year or so back. Laura Rosen Cohen in Toronto and Kate Smythe in Sydney are both great fans of his work with the Wombles from opposite ends of the Commonwealth. Anyway, Mike did a cracking job on this track. He added an electro-pop beat, I think that's what they call it, and some wailing guitars, and it was a big top 10 hit. But it was a bit of a tough session for Steve Harley. Sarah Brightman is a very pure soprano, so she starts off, nails her part in one take, and goes off for dinner, and Steve's there half the night trying to hit all his high notes dead center. But he got there. Beneath the Opera House, I know he's there.
Yeah.
And at that point, the Phantom crashes down the chandelier on the man she really loves. The then Mrs. Lloyd Webber, Sarah Brightman as Christine, and the late Steve Harley as the eponymous Phantom of the Opera, arranged and conducted and produced by our old chum Mike Batt. I'll give you the official Lloyd credits. Music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Lyrics by Charles Hart and Richard Stilgo. Additional lyrics by Mike Batt. So what does that actually mean? Well, I've known all four men over the years. A long time ago, I was having lunch with Sir Richard Stilgo, a delightful chap. And eventually I asked him, who wrote what in Phantom of the Opera? And he said, I wrote of and the. So a couple of years later, I asked Charles Hart, and he said, Andrew changes lyricists the way other men change their underpants, unquote. Which accurately conveys the nature of the relationship. And then some years after that, I asked Mike Batt, and Batty gave a most interesting answer. But unfortunately, there is a legal agreement in place constraining the official credits to the version I just gave you, at least until one or other or all of us are dead. Andrew Lloyd Webber had a very full underwear drawer on that show in the early work on Phantom of the Opera. He also asked Alan J. Lerner, author of My Fair Lady, Gigi, Camelot, to write the lyrics. And he asked Jim Steinman, the big rock songwriter, Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart, Meatloaf, I'd Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. He asked Jim Steinman to do the lyrics. But I've come over the decades to appreciate why a chap would want to change his underpants every 20 minutes. Phantom was one of those rare, perfect matches of composer and subject, as perfect as Lionel Bart and Oliver or Meredith Wilson and The Music Man. And he wanted a co-writer who connected with the material in the same way he did. Whoever did what, it was a top 10 hit for Sarah Brightman and Steve Harley in February 1986. I said, Steve, oh, so are you going to be the Phantom on stage? And he said, well, they're rather keen. He auditioned for Andrew, the director, Hal Prince, and the producer, Cameron McIntosh, and they called the next day to the next day. They called the next day to tell him he'd got it. And he rehearsed every day with Hal Prince for 5 months. And then they began to get cold feet about his acting chops. And a couple of days before the official announcement of the casting, he was told he would be replaced by Michael Crawford. And he had to make do with a severance check for 20,000 quid. He was telling me about this, and I said, oh, well, at least you got a big comeback pop hit out of it. And he said, yeah, but no one knows it's me, because in the pop video, and even on telly, on Top of the Pops and things like that, he's wearing a mask throughout the whole thing. So everyone watching thinks, oh, here's Sarah Brightman with a bloke in a mask. The vicissitudes of showbiz. Steve Harley, dead at 73. That'll do it for our show. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosenkahn will round up the internet as only she can. Our official Stein versus the Stick trial merchandise is still available, only now it's the official merchandising for the appellate hearing. Plus ça change, plus la même case, under the American system of trial by ordeal. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. all rights reserved.